You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Bronwyn Wild, tōku ingoa, nau mai, haere mai ki Te Wire. Mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Apa Wednesday, te rā te kaumātahi o Whiringa Ārangi, the 11th of November. My name is Bronnie and I'll be with you for the next hour for the last time, which is why I was just trying to make as many mistakes as I possibly could there. But luckily in the next weeks you'll be in the safe hands of Felix Walton, my producer, who is also here right now. How are you doing, Felix?
Good.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we've got Alan Blackman here as well. He'll be coming back, a familiar face.
Or voice.
Or voice, I should probably say. All right. If I can, they coming up on the show today. We have got Dear Science with Alan talking about the decline in average body temperature, new energy saving windows, and platypuses or platypi? Who knows? Glowing in ultraviolet light. I spoke to Deputy Leader of the ACT Party, Brooke Van Velden, about their criticisms of the Recognised Seasonal Workers, or RSE, scheme, and the Labour Party's proposal to do away with the full representation rule in Parliament. Felix, what have you got for us?
I did an interview with Air 2 about some payouts being given to Air New Zealand's executives.
And then lastly, I spoke to Reeve Gray, a psychology and Māori studies honours student at the University of Auckland, who's just been announced as one of this year's Rhodes Scholars. Ooh. Yeah. Ka we ware ware a hea na koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihere rokiroki, marunga te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, and if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 Waia mai rāne, or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. I tēnei wā tonu, engari, right now it's time for...
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
That sounds familiar. We already heard that sting once before. But kia ora MOTAT and kia ora Alan. How is it going?
It's going very well. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Now we're going to let Felix is going to take the lead on these questions a bit here, but I can get the ball rolling if we want. I hear the first story, the average body temperature has dropped. What's going on there?
Yeah, good question. And it's something I'd never really thought about until I saw this in the literature the other day. So we're all familiar with the your body temperature, what it should be, what it's meant to be, is 37.0 degrees Celsius. Or if you work in the old currency, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, which unfortunately this whole paper was gauged in, unfortunately, all of these Fahrenheits and things like that. But anyway, we're going to stick to Celsius. So where did this come from is the first question. Why 37.0 degrees? How long have we known this? And it dates back, in fact, to 1868 and a German physician by the name of Karl Wunderlich. And he went and wrote a book which described his studies of, get this, 1 million temperature readings from around about 25,000 patients. And he had a special thermometer they did this with, and it was about a couple of feet long or something like that. So this big, enormous, you know, not the sort of thing that you sort of, you know, easily slip under your tongue these days. And so that was basically the guts of his findings, was that, yep, the average human body temperature is 37.0 degrees. He realized that you did get some variation, obviously, during the day. And so it ranges from, or as he said, 36.2 degrees to 37.5 degrees. It's coldest in the middle of the night, so from 2 to 8 a.m. is when your body temperature is the lowest, and it's the highest from 4 to 9 p.m. So there's some sort of, yep, variation there. And so part of why he wanted to do this was obviously we all know that when we get sick, we get hot, our temperature increases and we get a fever. And so he was one of the first to recognize that the fever itself was not the problem, that the fever was more a symptom than a disease, and that the fever actually is a sign that your body is busy trying to fight an infection, some sort of an infection, and so that sort of mobilizes your T cells and stuff like that, and you know, gets your body going and your whole immune system, etc., etc., etc. And so that's been the case for the past, what is it, 150 odd years, this 37 degrees. However, there have been recent studies, a couple of recent studies. So in 2017, they did a study in the UK of 35,000 adults, and they found that the average body temperature there was 36.6 degrees Celsius. Mm. And a similar study in the States last year, 2019, they found an average body temperature of 36.4 degrees Celsius. And you might think, well, whoop-de-doo, you know, so what? You know, what difference does 0.6 of a degree Celsius make? And, well, you know, it is kind of interesting. Why has the average body temperature over the past 150 or so years dropped by, you know, about 1.4 degrees Celsius? That's, you know, an interesting enough question to have a look for an answer to. And so what a multinational team of workers started doing, in fact, I think 16 or so years ago, was that they started studying a group of Tsimani Amerindians who live in Bolivia. And they are sort of forager farmer people. And this was a multinational study, people in the US and Bolivia and the EU. And amongst other things, they were interested in measuring the body temperature of these folks. And so when this started, in around about the year 2000-ish, it was found that their average body temperature was 37.0 degrees Celsius, just like, you know, supposedly the rest of the world. And what they've found over the intervening or nearly intervening two decades was in fact a similar drop in body temperature, in average body temperature, down to around about 36.5 degrees Celsius. And that's really interesting because their average temperature has dropped over a span of about 20 years, whereas it's taken sort of the rest of the world sort of 200 years or, you know, 150 or so years for their body temperature to decrease by that much. And so therefore the obvious question is,
why?
Indeed. Wow. You know, they're seeing a decline in their body temperature of 0.05 degrees Celsius a year, which might not sound like a hell of a lot, but you add that up over a few years and it is in fact quite a bit. Yeah. So why? They've got the data now. So, you know, there's three studies and they had thought that probably the decline in the body temperatures measured in the UK and the States, you know, the so-called Western countries, must be due to sort of the Western lifestyle, you know, those sorts of things. And they weren't really fully expecting to see a similar sort of thing happening with these Bolivians.
Right, yeah. I wanted to ask, might this have something to do with external temperatures rising because of things like climate change? Do you think that could have some sort of influence? Or?
That's a good question. They did look at things like sort of the fact that the Western countries have got access to things like air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And so they live in a much more temperature-controlled climate.
It's just quite curious that you say the past 20 years among this group that were studied, it's accelerated. That sort of lines up with the time where we've seen, you know, big impacts from climate change.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I don't recall actually seeing that in the paper. I don't think they mentioned that as a possible reason for this or a cause of this. What they did say was that it could very possibly be due to something like antibiotics and the fact that there's an increasing prevalence of antibiotics all around the world. So that may have something to do with it. But what they were expecting, they obviously were expecting the Bolivian cohort would have more diseases than the Western, the so-called Western cohort. And so therefore they should have more inflammation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, more diseases, more inflammation, and so therefore their body temperature shouldn't be dropping. But it is, and so therefore that sort of says that inflammation and the immune activation that occurs is not influencing the average body temperature. And so they reckon antibiotics, that might be happening because that obviously reduces infection. Antibiotics are ubiquitous around the world now, you know. And what antibiotics can actually do is they can kill off some of your microbiome in your gut, your gut bugs. Mm. And those bugs, when they're active, they actually give out heat. And so therefore that could be a cause, if you're killing them off, then that could be a cause of decreasing temperature. So, and that was consistent with the fact that at the very, very start of the study, when they were studying the Bolivian cohort, they found that a particular respiratory illness that they would get would increase their temperature by a certain amount. But then sort of 5-10 years down the track, that very, very same respiratory illness wouldn't have the same effect, and it would only increase the temperature, you know, so they'd get a much milder fever. And, you know, this is, in fact, a study without an answer, which is nice because, you know, this is one of those ones where more study is required, obviously.
You love to see it.
But I think that's absolutely fascinating. Mm. You know, why? I think if anybody can answer that definitively, then, you know, there's that would be quite a big thing to actually
Send us a text if you've got an answer.
Please.
Was it 5395?
5395.
Yeah, so there you go.
All right, we'd better move on to this liquid window that can save energy. What's the deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, again, when I'm reading up for these Dear Science segments, I always am amazed by something every week, you know. And so today's amazing one is that buildings, from a 2009 UN study, buildings account for 40% of global energy usage. Buildings. Mm. That's astonishing. I had no idea.
From heating and
yeah, just everything and, you know, electricity and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, 40%, the building of the buildings, et cetera, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So buildings themselves, 40%. And windows are responsible for half of that.
Mm.
So we'd be a hell of a sight better position if we didn't have windows in our buildings.
Huh. Depends from which perspective you look at that.
And, you know, and I was thinking about that and I thought, yeah, good point. Igloos don't have windows, do they?
Mm.
You know? Because it would just be silly to. But we need our windows, obviously. We need to see out. And so obviously we're going to have to find a better way of making windows because that's an enormous energy consumption. Mm. That's huge. So there's work obviously going on in this area, so-called smart windows and things like that, that can sort of let in some light and not let in other light and et cetera, et cetera. And obviously if you're letting in too much visible light, you're getting heating up inside, and you know that's not necessarily going to be a good thing, so you're going to need your air conditioning on because it's going to get too hot inside. But then if your windows aren't big enough, then it's not going to warm it up enough inside, and it's going to be too cold, and so you're going to have to heat up the, you know, etc, etc, etc. So what these workers in Singapore have done is to say, right, let's use water for our windows. So let's take a couple of panes of glass, we're going to fill them up with the space between them with water plus a little additive, and this little additive is going to make all the difference. Okay, and this additive is called a hydrogel, and that's sort of a polymeric material that can be very responsive to visible light and in particular heat. And what happens is that they make these windows with this aqueous solution between them. When it gets too hot, they go opaque and they stop the visible light coming in and heating up the inside of the building. When they cool down, they go clear. And the big thing about water is it's got a very high heat capacity. Okay, I don't know if you've sort of ever noticed this, but it really does take a lot of energy to heat up water. Okay, so hence the name heat capacity. It's got a big capacity for heat. You've got to put a lot of heat in there to raise the temperature by a little bit. And conversely, when it's losing heat, it's very difficult for it to lose heat. It holds heat very well, which is why the oceans keep the Earth basically livable, right? Because that's an enormous heat sink that is very, very difficult to heat up and very, very difficult to cool down. Mm. And so that's the basis of these sort of smart window things, these water windows. And they have found significant energy savings in mock-ups of these things and prototypes, up to sort of around about 11% or so over the very best sort of smart windows that we've got at the moment, and huge when compared to just sort of, you know, a pane of glass sort of thing. So 30% more efficient than current energy efficient glass. And so this really is quite a big thing. You know, this could make enormous, enormous energy savings. Mm. And another nice byproduct of it all, because your windows are filled with water, then you get noise suppression, noise reduction. Okay, so things are less noisy out there.
Yeah, with all the construction going on outside, I think we could use some of that.
And indeed, there is right outside this window here. The view has gone. Okay, so you cannot.
It's
now.
Quite sad
for people who can't see. There's just a big old wooden wall.
For people who can't see, everybody else.
For those of you who can't see what it looks like in here,
but, yeah, we should move on to the last one. one because we don't have much more time, and surely, I am desperate to talk about platypuses. I don't think you understand how excited I am about this one. Platypus's fur glows in ultraviolet light.
Yep.
What the hell?
And this, again, is one of those amazing things that you'd sort of think, well, how the heck did they not come across this sooner? Yeah. And you're absolutely right. So platypus fur does glow under UV light. So in scientific terms, we say it fluoresces. And this was a nice story because it was a complete accident, because there were a bunch of folk
as most important discoveries.
A bunch of folk in the States who were studying flying squirrels. And apparently flying squirrels do the same sort of thing, that they are fluorescent, so they glow under ultraviolet light. And they'd found this in the wild, and they went to a museum in Chicago, the Field Museum in Chicago, and they were looking for specimens of these flying squirrels. And they found a few pelts and stuff like that, and they shone on UV light on them and found that, yes, they do indeed fluoresce. And then they were sort of looking in the neighbouring drawers and seeing what they had in there and stuff like that. So they found they had some marsupials and stuff. So they were looking for marsupials because apparently they do that as well. And there just happened to be a platypus in there as well. And so they went and shone the old ultraviolet light on this platypus. And surprise, surprise, it started fluorescing. So in addition, the platypus being one of the weirdest things on planet
Nature's
Earth,
greatest freaks.
So it's got these electrical sensors in its beak that can, or its bill, whatever you want to call it, that can detect electrical signals from its prey. It's one of the very few venomous mammals. And
it lays
eggs. I mean, you know, it's just a bizarre thing. And now to this long litany of weirdness, we can add the fact that it glows in ultraviolet light. And again, which obviously begs the question, why?
Yeah.
Because, you know, in nature, things don't just be. You know, there's got to be a reason.
Because it looks cool.
Yeah. It's a fashion statement.
Where's the ultraviolet that they're going to fluoresce in? And, you know, that's the thing. There's not a heck of a lot of ultraviolet light in nature. So why? And so people were sort of saying, well, it might perhaps, if you've got predators that can see into the ultraviolet, if these guys are busy absorbing the ultraviolet light, then they sort of are going to become less visible to their predators. But then somebody else said, well, they don't really have any predators. They might get chomped by a crocodile occasionally, but they're pretty nasty things themselves, you know, obviously not good eating or anything like that. So they don't really have a lot of natural predators. So people are thinking, well, you know, it might not be that. It might be a recognition thing, perhaps that they can see each other. They're apparently solitary animals. And so they might see this glowing ultraviolet thing in the distance and recognize it as being another platypus.
Nice friend radar.
But again, the control experiment in this paper hasn't been done, which surely is to just go out into the WAPS, find yourself a live platypus, get yourself an ultraviolet light and see if it glows or not.
There you go. That's a fun summer project.
Fun weekend trip.
Yeah, listeners, please. Listeners in Australia. Yeah, thank you so much, though. That's probably what we've got time for today. We're to leave Dear Science there, but we'll see you again in a fortnight, Alan.
Yeah, I won't see you again in a fortnight. So
no, you won't.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, so Felix will be here.
Yeah, best of luck with everything, and it's been, as always, a blast. So,
thank you.
Yeah, hope all
and
goes
I'll
well.
And I'll be back.
Cool.
I'll be back.
Okay.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
TEDx Auckland is back for another exceptional confluence of ideas, networking, culinary excellence, and of course, the famous after party. In a year with much more than its fair share of world-changing, paradigm-shifting moments, TEDx Auckland is your chance to join the conversation, making history and making sense of it at one of the very few live in-person TEDx events in the world. TEDx Auckland, Saturday, November 14th, less than 100 places remaining. Get your tickets now at tedxauckland.com.
14-ounce jeans, Kingsland. Any two branded table jeans for just $100. Plus, hella deals on tops. This weekend only. Friday 13th to Sunday 15th November. 377 New North Road, Kingsland. One mother of a jeans store.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so last century.
95BFM's popular shows, features and interviews are available as podcasts on RSS and Apple.
You listen to Totally Wired, the all-new music show. My name is Jess Fu.
Thanks for stopping by for the 95BFM Kids Show.
Welcome back, it's true.
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection.
So this is one for the musical theatre nerds out there.
Welcome along to Thursday Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry.
And we will let you know about Drive Island, of course.
Never miss out again. Becasts available on Apple Podcast or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
Air New Zealand has experienced a fair bit of turbulence over the past several months. The economic downturn caused by COVID-19 has resulted in a massive number of layoffs as the company attempts to downsize. And it's had to borrow money from the government in order to cover its losses. Hence the outrage following the news that a multi-million dollar share offer has been given to the company's CEO, as well as other members of the executive team. Around 4,000 workers have been laid off this year, with hundreds more crew due to be made redundant before Christmas. So the vibes aren't great, and these workers aren't in the best of moods. I spoke to Savage, the head of aviation at Air 2, a union that accounts for about a third of Air New Zealand's staff. Savage, who, in case you're wondering, goes by only one name, joined me, ironically, from Blenheim Airport. So could you explain to me what this share offer that is being given to Air New Zealand executives entails, and why is it such an insult?
Obviously, at Air New Zealand, there's thousands of union members and employees who have lost their job. Executives are given share offers as part of their performance pay. And there's two aspects here for the people who have been made redundant and for the people who are at the moment facing redundancy. One is the way in which they found out this information. There's always been an issue with executive pay, and finding out that these share offers have been made has been particularly hard for union members at the moment. And the other issue, of course, is just the larger issue of the level of executive pay in New Zealand, which has always been a burning issue.
Could you elaborate a little bit on the level of executive pay? How much are these people paid?
Christopher Luxon, the former CEO of Air New Zealand, was the highest paid CEO in New Zealand. And as for the executives and the general managers, rank-and-file union members and general employees don't get to find out how much they are paid, but we do know that there's a number of senior Air New Zealand leaders that are paid in excess of $1 million a year.
Do you think that the decision to give these shares to executives now is a responsible decision?
Well, Dame Therese, who's the chair of the board of Air New Zealand, has maintained that they are in line with ordinary, you know, standard company policy or standard approaches to this type of corporate pay. But in many respects, this is about how tone-deaf they have been to the mood of the company. Employers are feeling very disheartened and disenfranchised by senior management, and they don't have a lot of faith that the company is on the right track. So when they hear that there are going to be share offers, that there are potentially millions of dollars being made, that potentially their general managers are being offered $100,000 in shares, all these kinds of pieces of information, it can be really incredibly hard for them at a time when they've just said goodbye to all of their co-workers and that they're facing a lot of fears and apprehensions about whether or not their jobs are safe. So part of it is the level of pay, and part of it is how tone-deaf the executives have been to how they've announced it and how they've messaged it within the company.
So it's been pretty widely reported that Air New Zealand has had to lay off a lot of staff this year. Do you know how many staff have been laid off and how many remain?
In general figures, we're probably looking around 4,000 people have left Air New Zealand as a result of the pandemic and the economic downturn. In terms of our area, we used to have over 5,000 union members at Air New Zealand. Air New Zealand is a very unionised company, large amounts, probably the most unionised private sector employer in New Zealand. And we've probably lost a couple of thousand members, so we still have around 3,000 members. About a third of all Air New Zealand employees are members of Air 2. But that's a massive change, as you can imagine.
Yeah, so for those people who are still employed, how have recent events such as COVID been impacting their incomes, as well as just overall morale in the company?
That's a good question. Primarily, a lot of people rely on the overtime rates and on the penal rates that they make in their jobs. Some of them are relatively well paid, some of them are at minimum wage or just below living wage. and they rely on those contractual benefits that they've negotiated over the years. Obviously, with the downturn, not only is there less people around, but there's just less work around, less overtime, less work on the weekend.
Air New Zealand has already received subsidies from the government to aid in their economic recovery. Do you think that that money is being used properly?
New Zealand has received two amounts of money from the government. One was a very large wage subsidy payment. I can't remember the exact figure, around $8 million. The other amount of money they've received is not actually a subsidy. It's a loan given to them by the government. And they're currently using that loan in order to cover the losses that they're making. So there's no doubt about it that the company is not going to be making a profit this year, very unlikely to be making a profit next year. But at these particular times, the damage that was done to New Zealand was done primarily by the way in which they downsized so rapidly and the way in which they treated employees during that process. No one within the union movement and no one in New Zealand was going to argue that Air New Zealand could stay the same size because of COVID-19. That would have been ridiculous. But there's a way you can do these things, and there was a lot of damage done in the last 6 months. So these share offers and these reports of executive pay come at a time when employers are already feeling left out, already feeling as if senior managers aren't listening to them.
What would you like to see Air New Zealand do in response to this backlash?
There has to be a really big conversation about the level of executive pay. Air New Zealand often sees itself as a big corporate private company, but actually it's 52% owned by a taxpayer. It's a part of New Zealand's infrastructure.
Basically, this seems to be widely perceived as almost bailouts, like these people are essentially giving themselves bonuses because their company is not making as much money, which isn't necessarily an uncommon thing to see. I mean, when a lot of companies start to lose money, executives give themselves payouts. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this. Why does this sort of thing happen?
I'm not sure if I can answer that wider question other than to point to the fact that we have a corporate culture that rewards executives at an incredibly high rate of money, and that level of pay for executives just keeps going up and up and up. And the relationship between the, for example, the CEO's pay and the average worker's pay, decades ago it would have been something like 26 times the average worker, and now it's 1,000 times the average worker. So that's the backdrop of increasingly higher pay packets for senior corporate leaders. But one way to understand this in New Zealand is to think about the idea of performance pay and guaranteed performance pay. So just recently, Air New Zealand came to its employees and they said, you know, we need to save more money. What can we do? What can everyone do to do their fair share? And almost across the company and in many areas, workers agreed to give up their performance bonus payments that were due to them contractually. So they could have demanded that money, and they agreed that in order to offset more job losses and keep the company in a better financial position, that they would just give up their performance pay. And then what they hear is that the executives have not given up their performance pay. They've agreed to keep their performance pay. But it should be pointed out that these share offers are about the long-term performance of the company. So the company does have to perform and reach a certain point until those executives get the money. Now, at the same time, there's always been an issue in New Zealand over the board company bonus that is paid out to employees. That's a discretionary bonus. And the board gets to decide based on profits whether or not it distributes some of its profits to its employees. And no matter how many times the unions have attempted to negotiate that bonus to become contractual so that employees are guaranteed a bonus if the company reaches a certain amount of profit, the company's already rejected that. So what they're hearing and what they're seeing within their own company is executives getting a guaranteed bonus if the company reaches certain profit levels. But their bonus is always discretionary and is always at the discretion of the board. And that's something that really sticks with them and is obviously something that needs to change.
Thank you to Savage from Air 2 for joining me for that interview.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
This morning I spoke to ACT Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden as you heard in that sting. Last week, the announcement of the special votes saw the Māori Party gain an extra seat in Parliament because of the full representation rule. This rule allows an electorate MP to bring list MPs into Parliament with them to reflect the proportion of the party vote, regardless of whether they meet the 5% threshold. I spoke to Brooke about the ACT Party's reaction to the Labour Party announcing they would do away with the rule, which has been very beneficial to ACT in the past. We began, however, by talking about the ACT Party's criticism of the government's Recognised Seasonal Worker, or RSE, scheme. Van Velden recognised two problem areas.
There are two things here with the RSE workers. There's what was happening before COVID and what's happening now. So currently the government has not set really clear rules of the game and has allowed some RSE workers in, for the example, in the fisheries sector, but it hasn't in some of our horticultural industry, and we've seen fruit and vegetables just rotting on the ground because people in those industries can't get the usual workers that they would in during the season that they would. And that's going to be a real problem because, you know, we've got zucchinis up in Northland that are currently ripening and they're just turning to mush. No one's there to actually pick them that would usually come in from overseas. And in a few months' time, we're going to be having the stone fruit season as well. So those are things like your apricots, your plums and your cherries. And those are huge exporters for us. And if we don't get those workers in, then we have this real problem that we're not exporting out and we're not helping our economy during the COVID crisis. But this has been an ongoing issue. I mean, for years the ACT Party has been saying that we shouldn't be capping our RSE workers because what happens is that industry employers have to go to the government and say, could we please have some workers to come in, and they're allocated for them. So we've been saying for years that we should get rid of that cap, because what ended up happening last year was some of our strawberry growers and other groups weren't able to get the workers that they needed. They went to the government, and the government just didn't decide on how many RSE workers were supposed to be allowed in. The timeline was pushed back for months and months and months, and that caused a huge amount of stress and anxiety amongst some of our exporters. And, you know, during COVID, there are actually a lot of companies that would be willing to bring people in, and it doesn't seem right that the government has said, yes, we can bring some people in for fisheries, but we can't bring in the Samoan workers that we usually would for our horticultural industry.
And so, yeah, ACT's contention is kind of this has been a two-pronged issue, and it's the fact that it has been capped in the past that has now led us to the situation we are, because if we were to lift the cap now, that wouldn't be a solution, right? Because we would still have to get all the people over here, they have to quarantine. And
yeah, that's right. So if we weren't in this COVID reality, we would still be saying let's get rid of that cap, because there are workers that our businesses do need here, and it's seasonal work, so these aren't full-time jobs for months and months. These are short stints, and that money is actually really important to go back to the islands. You know, this is like a two-way system. We need the workers, and people from the islands want the money. You know, it goes back to those places where it helps families. And so currently we've kind of closed off our borders to our island friends and said, sorry, you can't come in here and use that usual money that you would have for seasonal work. So we're also saying to our businesses that usually rely on it, sorry, you can't get the workers either. And there doesn't seem to be a clear case why not, because there isn't any COVID in the islands.
A lot of people were using the argument that there are a lot of New Zealanders out of work, and so maybe they could benefit from having first priority of these jobs. But why are we not seeing New Zealanders taking up those jobs?
Well, it's the same reason at the moment as why it has been for years. There's always been a shortage of people wanting to take up seasonal work. And I can see the argument of saying we have people on the job seeker benefit looking for work, but those jobs have never been filled. You know, in the case of, I think it was Brett Heath, who was up on Monday talking about the zucchinis, you know, he goes and approaches people for job seeker benefit work, and they just don't want to take it up. And I think, you know, there is a big difference here between people who have lost their jobs in COVID living in Auckland and telling them that they should suddenly move temporarily to Kerikeri for a job that can only be for a few weeks. So, I mean, there's a lot of uplifting that would happen that we wouldn't actually want to see happen in New Zealand. But it is short-stinted work, and I think we should be allowing people who usually have that opportunity to come into New Zealand, especially if those companies are willing to quarantine people, you know, at their own expense.
If we were just to come back to the idea of an uncapped RSE, are there any concerns around that, though, that then you end up with more workers than you actually need?
No, I mean, it would sort it out for itself, but essentially what happens now is that there's an allocation system. So, you know, the government might say we're allowing in a certain number of thousand per people this year for RSE, and that gives a lot of uncertainty to a business because they have to essentially go to the government and ask to be given an allocation, a small portion of those number of employees, even if they wanted more of them. So there's always been a shortage. The prime example was in strawberries, but the real issue there is that there is a need to ask the government for the workers rather than being able to say we actually need 1,500 and going out to the market and getting 1,500 people. The government might come back and say, well, during the allocations we're giving you 1,300, so you're getting this shortfall of 200 people. If a business needs employees, they should be able to go out and get them.
And I know there already have been concerns in the past about seasonal workers being taken advantage of and underpaid. Do you not think, would an uncapped system not exacerbate this and kind of create a race to the bottom where those who are willing to work for the least will be prioritised?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think where there is exploitation, it certainly should be taken care of. But I would say that in all aspects of work, not just RSE workers, there's always going to be, you know, one little bad apple somewhere. But that doesn't mean that we should, you know, need government to take care of all of it. Certainly, I think in all cases of employment law, where someone is breaking it, they should be held accountable for that.
Thank you, Brooke. And bad apple was a very fitting metaphor, might I just add. If we moved on now to the second topic of full representation. Now, there's an ACT press release saying that Labour is against the idea of full representation. Where have they actually said that? Because I was trying to find a press release from Labour or a comment. Or has that just been a long-standing position of theirs?
Oh, I think it was raised in the media a few days ago. I do remember seeing where it was, but like you, I wouldn't actually be able to tell you where I've seen it. But the issue of full representation, it did come up this week, especially around whether we should get rid of the full representation, which is if a party wins an electorate seat and also gets a certain percentage of the party vote that's under the 5% threshold, whether or not they should be entitled to more seats in Parliament. And the issue there really is if we got rid of it, we would be not allowing what is a genuine representation in Parliament. And the classic example is the Māori Party winning its second seat. And to get rid of that would be to deny them representation of people who did want their party in Parliament.
Yeah, I guess one sort of criticism of that, though, is that it's not really a full representation, though, is it? Because, I mean, the Māori Party did get less percent of the votes than New Zealand First, the Opportunities Party, and even New Conservative. So I guess some people see it as unfair that just because you get a seat, then suddenly you get to sneak in and more members and bypass what is actually a proportionate representation of what the New Zealand public voted for.
Mm. I think there's a different way of looking at it, though, in that, you know, the system MMP was designed to ensure that people who are represented well, want representation can get represented, but also to ensure that people who have such a fringe view can't be elected into Parliament and win power. And I think it strikes a really good balance there, in that it's actually quite hard to win, you know, 1 in 20 votes, 1 in 20 people around the country, or the geographic support of an area of people. You know, and there is not going to be a fringe view that's coming through if you're getting a whole geographic area of people to represent. And in doing so, I think you meet that threshold of, is this a genuine idea that people want to be represented in Parliament, or is it a very, very fringe view? And so by winning a whole geographic area and also winning a proportion of representation throughout New Zealand, I think you should be entitled to having a second or third seat, because, you know, you've already managed to make that threshold of valid view.
And the reason that ACT is saying that Labour wants to get rid of this is because it doesn't suit Labour's own political advantage. But I guess, I mean, the obvious response to that being maybe the reason ACT wants to keep it is because in the past it has been very helpful to ACT as well. So I guess it kind of points to that importance of having consensus in electoral law.
Yeah, I think there's an importance of making sure that we're not just changing electoral law to fit anyone's political agenda. Changing an electoral law would actually be a huge constitutional change. And I think you'd have to point to what is the reason for changing it, and is there a problem with the status quo? And I don't think that there is actually a problem with the status quo, because like I said, you either have to get the support of an entire geographical area of people, which is not easy to do, or have 1 in 20 people nationwide want you to represent them in Parliament. And I think that has worked well in the past, but also it's allowed us to have more diversity in the system that we wouldn't have seen before MMP. And so to kind of change it either one way or the other would be for a political advantage of one side or the other. So I would say we shouldn't be changing it.
Yeah, just interestingly, I did note though that this isn't actually one of the entrenched provisions of the Electoral Act. So, I mean, it doesn't require a 75% majority. So Labour, with the majority, you know, the over 50% they have in Parliament, could change it themselves.
Yeah, and I would really query what the purpose of them doing that would be, if that was something that they wished to go ahead with, because it could only be seen that it would be for a political gain. And I don't think that would be good for our democracy.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
Ka hoki mai mātou a muri tēnei. We've just got some ads coming up and we'll be back with a final piece for you.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa.
Kōanga, spring.
What do you call this weather?
Life-giving?
Kōanga has sprung, my friend. Soak up the renewal. It's hot, but it's raining?
Yeah, real gumboots and stubbies weather.
Kōanga, spring.
Māori words, karawhiua, give it a go.
Provocative, eccentric, outrageous, WTF.
It's definitely not your usual night at the museum.
WTF by Motat takes you outside your comfort zone with weird and wild performance art, music, activities and more.
WTF, Saturday, November 21 at Motat, Great North Road. Strictly R18, tickets from motat.nz.
Prepare for the experience of a life, time, romance.
Oh, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
Well, hello to everyone in Texas, by the way, as well.
Hey, say hello, everybody.
Oh, shit, it is all of Texas.
Intrigue.
Got that grill. Here we go.
This is a sandwich press. It's not like the George Foreman.
It's being used like a George.
Drama.
You do get approached by a lot of people going,
this is the most amazing thing I've ever done in my life.
Action.
Here we go.
Oh, the phone worked.
It's the cornhole guy.
What's up, cornhole
guy? How are you?
95 BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Changing
your whole perspective on crap every weekday from 4 till 7 p.m. Only on 95 BFM.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire.
The prestigious Rhodes Scholarship is awarded to outstanding scholars every year from around the world to study at the University of Auckland. Of the 95 scholars this year, three New Zealand Rhodes Scholars have been named: Liam Dennis, Jessica Sutton and Reeve Gray. This morning I spoke to Reeve, an honours student in clinical psychology and Māori studies at the University of Auckland, from Ngāti Tūwharetoa ki Taupō, Ngāti Manunui and Ngāti Porou. We talked about the application process and how he hopes to use the opportunity to further the kaupapa around Māori youth flourishing and mental health.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Reeve Gray tōkingoa, ko Tongariru te maunga, ko Taupō Nui a Tia te moana. Nō Tūwharetoa hou. Yeah, kia ora everyone, my name's Reeve. Studying at Auckland University in my honours year of the clinical psychology program here, and recently was lucky enough to be, I don't know how, but named one of 2021's Rhodes Scholars for the New Zealand district.
Yeah, which is why, yes, you're here today.
Yes,
so
yeah.
Has this been like a long-term goal for you? When did this come on your radar?
Nah, if I'm to be honest, I didn't actually even know about the Rhodes Scholarship until the end of 2019. And honestly, I was kind of gutted that I'd only just heard about it then, but it's sort of something I spoke about in my application. These things aren't really marketed, you know, to Tane Māori like me in school. Mm. That wasn't really something, because I'm from Taupō. I think it's just not something on our radar. Like, you're either told when you leave school in Taupō that, you know, the common thing is that you're going to work in agriculture or tourism or something like that, and people heading to university were the minority from there, and then Māori people from there were even further minority.
Yeah.
Heading to university. So yeah, found out about it quite late, but once I found out about it and sort of maybe the opportunities it could afford me or what I could maybe do with it, yeah, I just sort of committed to it, went full steam on it.
Yeah.
Had a lot of help though, like heaps of help.
I think that's a huge part about it as well too, yeah, is that the doors it could open for you in the future going forward.
Yeah, and not just for me, but like on a more like implicit level as an example, like for people like me in Taupō to open those doors for young Māori who, like, they could see that as something that could happen.
Yeah.
I don't know, that means a lot to me because that's what happened to me. KD from anthropology, she's a student here. I saw her get the scholarship, and to me it was like, that's a person I relate to and we're sort of alike. I could get it too.
Yeah.
And she sort of showed me that possibility, if I can do that for someone else who is a little bit whakamā to apply for these things like I was before seeing her do something like that.
Yeah.
Then, you know, not just opportunities for me but opportunities for others is, yeah, means a lot. Yeah.
And how was that application process?
It was pretty hectic. Yeah, it was hectic. It was the most hectic application or anything I've had to do. So it's quite rigorous on paper, but it's also rigorous in terms of like the cognitive space that takes up in your mind. Like, it took, like, I think the overall, the process is about 6 months.
Mm.
It just drags out and it feels really long. And if you're lucky enough to make the final interviews, you're just so tired.
And all the while, you were doing this alongside trying to study for your honours as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it sucks because I do feel like, say I'd committed to my honours solely, I have to admit I probably could have done a better job on it. I'm still going to try and do my best on it, but
yeah.
You got to balance that out.
I mean, the idea being now you will have the chance to, I guess, continue that research that you're doing now in Oxford.
Yeah.
What is your current honours on?
So it sort of dictated a lot for you, but I was lucky in that my supervisor, Ian Lambie, gave me a little bit of freedom. Obviously, that freedom got cut down further with COVID and stuff. So we ended up retrospectively looking at a data set he already had of adolescents with harmful sexual behaviours. More specifically, the backgrounds of Māori adolescents with harmful sexual behaviours and how we can better understand the kind of worlds that they're coming from to improve treatment and prevention for that.
Mm.
Yeah. It plays into what I'm very interested in, which is young people and young Indigenous thriving kind of thing.
Mm.
Much like I just talked about with applying for this, I want to see more equity when it comes to young Indigenous people the world over kind of thing. So I'm glad in my honours project I'm able to fulfil that. I'm glad, like, with the Rhodes Scholarship I'm able to fulfil that.
Yeah, so do you have any idea of what you're going to be able to study when you're over there, what you're going to focus on, or are you going to be quite restricted?
So I have a vision for what I want, like the programs I want to get into. The first one is the Masters of Public Policy and the... this is a long one, Masters of Social Intervention and Policy Evaluation. And it's just to increase my understanding of governance, systems and policy when it comes to the things I've looked at in psychology and Māori studies and how I can best integrate those together to create change in the communities that I care about.
And obviously, so to get one of these scholarships, you have to pretty good grades, but they also look at other things as well.
Yeah.
What are the other sort of things that you've been involved with that relate to your degree?
That is another reason that after learning of these big international scholarships and stuff, this one appealed more to me because it was, I don't know, I like university and I like getting good grades and stuff like that, but I haven't ever seen myself as the like straight cut academic kid. So at university, I don't know, I haven't really sought out many things. I've just taken up opportunities that are presented to me. So like, I think it all started with like tour kind of, and just like starting there, and like I really like the kaupapa of helping other Māori students achieve better in the courses and stuff. I volunteered at Mount Eden Corrections Facility while I was studying. I was lucky enough there too to be working a lot in the youth unit. I mean, it's hard helping as much as you can with all the inmates there on remand, so it's a very transitional sort of stage at what's happening there, so just helping with planning afterwards and what's going to happen next. Also, we ran workshops on sort of decision making and things around impulsivity and working with that feeling and what that, you know, what we can do about feeling like that sometimes. So just we presented situations and things to them, and it was really fun. I really enjoyed it, just to connect with them. And
so that was quite an application of your psychology.
Yeah. Well, it got advertised in one of our psych classes. I just took it up through there. But again, so something that I just saw, I was like, oh, okay, I'm passionate about that. I'll devote time to that. So, but there is, to me, a commonality throughout, and that's all, it's all sort of linked to young people, young Māori people, and helping them thrive kind of thing.
Another thing is, obviously, you're no stranger to being behind the microphone, because you also had a podcast.
I started this podcast around, I'm quite passionate about, obviously, Māori are hugely overrepresented in our atrocious statistics around mental health, and there's a lot of sort of systemic factors associated with that. I don't want to feel powerless in there. I can't really deal with those. What can I do sort of in a small way to help with this issue? And a lot of it for me came down to just the lack of conversation about it. So I wanted to start something, open up a forum like many are, and to just have those conversations, especially with young men, around what's going on, challenging notions of masculinity and challenging notions of you're not talking about it. I guess also I wanted to provide a little bit of nuance around these things. I see that as the next move we can make is, okay, we've brought mental health to the table for this population that are suffering. Now we need to be a little bit nuanced in providing them with tools and make the conversation a little bit more detailed for specific issues, because we're talking about mental health as this big umbrella thing, but there's a lot within that. You know, there's anxiety versus depression, there's loneliness going on. But basically, if I started a podcast just to talk about it with people I thought that would provide experiences that were valuable for other people to hear.
That was Reeve Gray, Rhodes Scholar for 2021. Often such awards are seen as an individual achievement, but Reeve was very clear to emphasise that all the help, to emphasise all the help he has received, saying his success is the result of a collective effort.
That was The Wire.
Kōra te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. One final mistake for the show, I just forgot to pin my mic on. But that brings us to the end of our show for another week. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki a māua mō tēnei rā. Big thanks to all those who spoke to us for the show today: Alan Blackman, Brooke Van Velden, Savage and Reeve Gray. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou, e whakarongo ana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in and sent in those great texts. Ka hoki mai mātou, a tērā wiki, will be back next week with Felix in the driver's seat and me producing. How are you feeling about that, Felix?
It's very exciting.
I'd like to thank you for this great order, this great honor.
I'm dreading it a little bit, but that's fine. Yeah. After all the mistakes you made this week, it's
honestly, it couldn't go any worse.
Should be easy to follow up.
And that's what I was just doing, you know, I was just lowering the expectations. So next week's going to be great.
Thank you, that's
great.
Very nice of you.
So make sure you all tune in. Up next is Bridge with the 1-4. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te irirangi poho. You're listening to 95 BFM.